I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
I'm Frank Stacio.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq's interim prime minister has issued what he says is the final call to Shiite militants in Najaf to disarm and vacate the holy Imam Ali shrine. The call comes amid threats that Iraqi troops might storm the holy site to end weeks of bloody battles with forces loyal to Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. There had been signs in recent weeks that the crisis may be coming to a head. Joining us from Najaf is Scott Baldoff of the Christian Science Monitor. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Scott, yesterday we heard that al-Sadr had agreed to disarm. Today it seems that he's withdrawn that pledge, if he ever made it. What are you hearing?
Well, there seem to be, number one, there are two different deals on the table. One that he says that he accepted. This was a deal that was offered by the National Conference delegation that came to Najaf just a day or two ago. Muqtada al-Sadr did not meet with the delegation, but his aides did, and Muqtada al-Sadr sent a letter to the delegation back to Baghdad, which said that he basically agreed to disarm, to leave the shrine, and to leave it in the government authorities' hands. And now we're getting a different deal. There is an additional demand that Muqtada al-Sadr needs to say that the Mahdi army is finished as a political or a military unit. And that is a new deal that they're not willing to accept. Muqtada al-Sadr's spokesman, Sheikh al-Shabani, said that he rejects these conditions entirely.
And al-Sadr is saying that this was imposed after he'd already agreed to the previous deal. Is that the idea?
Correct.
Yeah. And also we hear today that there was an attack on a police station in Najaf. What do you hear about that?
Well, it just happened very close to us, actually. We heard mortars landing at around 2 o'clock on a nearby police station. There are reports of 7 killed inside and several wounded as well. The police seem to be bearing the brunt, actually, of the Mehdi Army's anger. There are fighters for Mehdi Army throughout the streets of the new city, a new part of the city, outside of the area of where most of the military operations are taking place. These are supporters, many of them, who have come from outside of Najaf to harass American troops from behind, and particularly the police force.
Does al-Sadr have complete control over these forces, or can some of them act independently?
Well, there are a lot of people who are not even a member of his organization. There have been rumors of even some Sunni radicals from up north in Fallujah who have come down just for the pleasure of fighting against a common enemy, the Americans. Mm-hmm. Even members of his own militia are not all that relatively new to the organization and therefore may not be as well trained or well organized or disciplined or as interested in any loyalty with Muqtada al-Sadr himself. So the answer is no. We don't really see that much cohesion among these groups, but around the shrine itself and inside the shrine, we got in there today, there is a very heavy, there's certainly a strong spirit, commitment to the cause, and they do appear ready to fight to the end.
And we've heard from Iraqi officials, separate Iraqi officials over the past couple of days, suggestions that Iraqi troops will storm the site. We'd heard that that was pretty much out of the question because of the possible backlash. Is that a real possibility?
Well, according to what the Iraqi officials have been saying now for the last couple of days, it is a very strong possibility that they will launch a final assault on the shrine. The American soldiers that we talked to today indicated that there is a possibility that the shrine may come under a very firm attack. This was one of the things that they were telling us when a group of journalists tried to get into the shrine today. They said that the shrine may not be around much longer.
Scott, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Scott Baldoff is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. A new blood test administered in the early stages of breast cancer treatment could help predict the success of that treatment. According to an article in today's New England Journal of Medicine, the technique can determine potential outcomes in a matter of weeks and could allow physicians to adjust or alter treatment plans quickly. Dr. Massimo Cristofili is of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. He's the lead author on the study, and he joins us now from Houston. Dr. Cristofili, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Can you start by telling us a little bit about how this test works?
Well, the test is a simple blood test, and we do have a response in a matter of a few hours if the patient has cancer cells circulating in the blood or not. Obviously, if you do have circulating cancer cells, your prognosis is extremely bad, and of course, this is a significant finding because we didn't have a technique and an available result from this particular type of test so far. So we can select the type of treatment based on this result, and we can follow the response and predict the response in a matter of a few weeks.
Tell us when you administer this test. Is this after you've begun, say, chemotherapy or some kind of treatment?
Usually before starting any form of treatment, we would like to consider that this is the best guidance for treatment, a baseline for patient with newly diagnosed metastatic disease. So before starting any new treatment, and this treatment can be chemotherapy or hormonal treatment according to what the clinicians feel more appropriate. And then this test was administered to the patients every month. And as you can see from the reports, after 1 month, there was already an indication if the patient were having any efficacy from the treatment or not.
So the initial test is a baseline, and then you continue to test. And what it allows you to do, I guess, is to stop treatment midstream and change if you find it's not working.
Correct.
How long before this test is made available to physicians?
Well, the test will probably become available to the United States in the next few months, probably by the end of the year. For next month, will be available to MD Anderson, so patient who comes to our clinic will be able to be tested with this.
You know, when I read about this, my first thought was, well, what if you haven't given it enough time, and will a patient be concerned that maybe you're shutting off a potentially effective treatment too early?
Well, that's a possibility, of course, and in fact, I don't think this is a confirmatory final study in order to evaluate if one treatment is superior or one treatment needs to be continued for a few more weeks in order to see the real efficacy. Probably this does not apply for hormonal treatment. In fact, I think we pointed out in the article that this may not apply to every treatment. But there are some other studies that are going to be started soon looking specifically at the effect of changing the treatment based on the lack of disappearance of the cells to see if this can change the prognosis of the patient or not.
How important is it that a treatment that may not be effective be stopped early?
Well, this is something that we don't know. We never done this before. It's not our current standard practice, so it's obviously something that we need to get used to, and we need to confirm that this is really a way to continue to follow.
Will it be an expensive test?
It will not be very expensive, and in fact, I think it's comparable to other serum tumor markers.
Dr. Cristofanilli, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Massimo Cristofanilli is an oncologist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas.
Although most of us will go to the polls on November 2nd, Election Day, political analysts predict that nearly a third of all voters may forego the official day and vote early. People in Iowa, for example, can make their choices a mere 3 weeks after the Republican National Convention. And in Arizona, up to half the ballots might be cast before Election Day there. It's a growing trend and could have profound, if not unpredictable, implications for this year's neck-and-neck presidential race. John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal and has been writing about all of this. Hi, John.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Good, thanks. In a race as close as this one, why do analysts think that so many of us are going to be voting long before November 2nd?
Gail, the biggest reason is changes in American culture. People are so busy and pressed for time. So the political system has looked for ways to make it easier for them to vote, and no excuse, early voting is one way. The X factor this year, which may inflate the phenomenon further, is fear of terrorism. There's been a lot of talk about Al-Qaeda possibly trying to do something to disrupt the election, and analysts think there will be some segment of voters, we don't know how big it is, who would like to avoid going to polling places and therefore will go try to cast their vote early.
Now, you just mentioned a phrase I hadn't heard before, no excuse voting. What is that as opposed to excuse voting?
States have moved toward, 29 of them have ways for you to vote now, and you don't have to, in effect, give an excuse from your doctor like a school kid would for missing class. You don't have to prove that you've been on a business trip or anything like that. You can just say, this is how I want to vote. And the ways you can do that are by mail, or in a lot of states, they set up remote polling stations where you can go in and vote at your convenience.
And how many people are we talking about here?
in Oregon, which is the furthest on the frontier on this area, all of the votes are going to be cast by mail. In other states, like Arizona and Nevada, perhaps half of the vote will be cast that way. Florida, which had so many difficulties with its voting process in 2000, analysts think about a third of that vote could be cast before November 2nd.
Well, a third, a half, I mean, those numbers are astonishing. Who is the group of people who find this most appealing?
Well, there are lots of specific types of voters who the two parties are targeting. On the Democratic side, you have minority groups, blacks and Hispanics, who are pretty clearly leaning toward the Democratic ticket, but historically have not turned out in rates as high as white voters have. For Republicans, they're looking at some married women who may have kids in daycare and jobs during the daytime and just plain have trouble making it to the polls on Election Day. Similarly, people who travel frequently, people who have long commutes, who may live in growing counties outside of metropolitan areas, all those are people who may be stuck in traffic when the polls close. For those voters, parties want to get those ballots, get them marked early, get them in the bank for their candidates, and they're working very aggressively to do that.
Well, with all of these states having different rules, in effect, you're not going to have a single election day. You're going to have a rolling one. And I wonder what implications that holds in terms of election day. And when you say these groups think that they have the votes in the bank, but they don't really know which way these people voted, do they?
Well, they don't, except that parties have gotten very good at targeting voters. They know who is for them and who has requested an absentee ballot. And they can then track whether the person has voted, because not the substance of your vote, but whether you have voted absentee is a matter of public record. Now, in terms of the implications for the political process, some people worry that we lose something in our society when people vote in the privacy of their own homes, either by mail or by the Internet, that there's a common civic act of turning out at the polling place. But it looks like the trend is in that direction, and we're simply going to have to think about elections in a different way, not necessarily a one-day event.
And, John, finally, when are the votes actually counted? After Election Day at some point?
The voters are counted on election night with all the others, although parties have a good idea of how many of their partisans have sent in their ballots.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch. Thanks, John.
You bet.
John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And we'll have more on this year's voting process and the technology behind it a little later in the program.
Coming up next, we look at the continuing ethnic conflict between Hutus and Tutsis in Africa.
And later in the program, runners on your mark, Olympic athletes get ready for track and field.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Frank Stasio.
It's Here and Now.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has asked the Security Council to double its peacekeeping force in the Democratic Republic of Congo to almost 24,000 troops. That request comes almost 200 Tutsi refugees in a neighboring Burundi were massacred 10 years ago. That follows the genocide that was 10 years ago. In fact, 200 Tutsi refugees in neighboring Burundi were massacred last week. Rwandan and Burundi officials are threatening to send soldiers into the Democratic Republic of Congo to capture the rebels responsible for that attack. Joining us to talk about the ethnic violence in the Great Lakes region of Africa is Edouard Boustan, who is a political science professor in the African Studies Center at Boston University. Professor Boustan, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Is this a continuation of the civil war between Tutsis and Hutus that led to the genocide in Rwanda 10 years ago?
Well, not exactly a continuation, but it's an episode in what is in many ways a sort of more complicated and more protracted situation, of which the Hutu-Tutsi conflict. This is only one part.
Well, has the situation gotten more complicated over the past 10 years, or are these simply the same problems that have not been adequately dealt with in the time since the genocide?
Well, the situation has certainly become more complicated, of course, in two respects. First, of course, in the form of the Rwanda genocide of 1994, which in a number of ways is in a category by itself, you might say, and not directly related to the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Also, because of the imbrication between the conflicts in these neighboring territories, between the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, in which the problems are somewhat but not entirely related.
The Tutsis in this region are a minority, but have, at least in contemporary history, held the lion's share of political power and economic power, and that has fueled much of the resentment.
The Tutsi are a minority, between 10-15%. The figures are a little bit unclear. In the case of Rwanda, at the time of independence, when elections were held, were under universal suffrage for the first time, the weight of the Hutu majority manifested itself, and there was a revolution whereby the traditional system, the traditional dominance of the Tutsi came to an end, at which point some Tutsi, a minority actually of the Tutsi, went into exile. Generally speaking, the better educated or the more powerful or the wealthier Tutsi. In Burundi, on the other hand, the Tutsi never really left power. They tried to share it or created some sort of a facade, shall we say, in which there was some co-optation of the Hutu, but the reality of power remained in the hands of the Tutsi. And, well, by and large, it still does, despite the attempts that have been made in recent years to work out a compromise between Hutu and Tutsi in Burundi, and the tentative power-sharing agreement that they've tried to work out is still being rejected by many on both sides of the fence.
The international community has been criticized, and certainly was criticized, for not responding quickly enough 10 years ago. This time, Kofi Annan wants the Security Council to double the number of peacekeepers in the Congo. Will that address the problem? Will that address the problem in the Great Lakes region of Africa?
It's not clear whether the doubling of the force will help. I mean, it will help to some extent, but whether it will be sufficient, of course, remains to be seen. It's sad, by the way, that while a peace agreement was signed between the warring factions in the Congo Civil War, its implementation still lags behind. And earlier this year, of course, there was, for all practical purposes, a resumption of the civil war in eastern Congo, very likely with the covert assistance of Rwanda. And much of what's been happening, including the massacre of Katuga camp, in fact, is a sort of direct consequence of that.
So you're saying that the political settlement between Tutsis and Hutus, that power-sharing agreement, really can't begin to take shape until there's stability in those three countries. And of course, it is precisely that ethnic conflict across the region and across those borders that has destabilized the three countries.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. In fact, it's a chicken versus egg controversy, if you will. The conflict between Hutu and Tutsi is often really rooted at the local level in rural communities and perceived somewhat differently from one region or from one locality to another. Much has to do, for instance, with land holding.
Could it be that peacekeepers need to think small and work in these small regions to tackle this one problem at a time?
Well, if there's going to be some sort of military operation or quasi-military operation, obviously it will have to be local. It's not countrywide.
What I'm really talking about is not the military side, but in a diplomatic sense, a rapid deployment force, in the sense that they are that they're targeted to these very specific, very regional kinds of problems and solve them one at a time.
Well, yes, of course, ideally, and not generally speaking, of course, this is the way that any kind of diplomacy should proceed.
Professor Boustan, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Edouard Boustan is a political science professor in the African Studies Center at Boston University.
And this note from Africa, the United Nations Food Relief Agency is gearing up for a critical stage in feeding refugees in Western Sudan as more people flee ethnic violence there and the rainy season peaks. The number of displaced people in the Darfur region has now reached 1.2 million, according to the UN. The World Food Program plans to airlift 100 tons of food a day into West Darfur, the area most affected by the rains. The food may need to be airdropped, depending on ground conditions. Italy has also flown emergency supplies into Darfur, including high-protein food, tents, and generators. Another Italian shipment is expected in Darfur next week.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, from an ROTC to Afghanistan, we hear one soldier's story.
And the director's cut of the cult film Donnie Darko is back in theaters. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Frank Stacio. Robin Young is off today.
It's Here and Now.
Most of the votes cast by Americans this November will be recorded in computerized voting booths, and a third of these votes will have no paper proof, no paper trail. According to one of our next guests, that is a formula for disaster. Ronnie Duggar is a journalist whose recent article in The Nation makes for some disturbing reading. Welcome, Ronnie.
Nice to be here, sir.
Tell us a little bit about this. I need to be clear about what it means when we say there's no paper trail. What happens when I vote?
It means that you go to the touchscreen, you cast your vote the way you want it counted. You don't know if it's being counted that way because there's no voter-verified ballot that you've made. The ballot is enmeshed in the computer, and the computer then counts your vote as the computer programmer has instructed the computer to count it, and you don't know if it's counted correctly or not.
All right. If there was a paper trail, how would that work?
It would permit you to go back and recount, either the way they've recently done in Venezuela or as they do in any test or random election. You can recount the ballots for certain precincts and see if they've been reported honestly.
But can't they just print out what it is I touched into the screen?
Yes, they do. In fact, they retain from 3 to 7 ballot images or the equivalent of ballot images in each machine. But once you corrupt the first one, you've corrupted all of them. So you can print out any kind of ballot image you want to and say it's been cast. The problem is the secret ballot. Your ballot is separated from you. And after it's separated from you and is counted in a computer where you, of course, can't watch what the bits are doing, it can be stolen.
So I could vote and I could write in a line or two of code that says every third vote, you know, no matter what it says, cast it this way.
Well, you can key an algorithm of that kind, a Trojan horse or a trapdoor. You can key it to the way the votes are turning out. And you can start switching 1 out of 10 votes, say, to the candidate of your choice to prevent the election from going the way it would have otherwise.
Yeah, but that's an easy—I mean, if you're writing into the code, I just check the code later and I'd find it.
No, you instruct the—for example, you have time-limited projects. You simply instruct the computer to erase the evidence that you've done it.
How would the paper ballot work then, the paper receipt? Would I get a copy of my vote? How does that happen?
In the Mercury method, you go to the touch screen, you cast your ballot, you then inspect a paper printout under glass that shows you what you've voted. You then push the ballot to cast it, and the paper ballot that you have made and verified goes into a box available for recounting.
So you
never see it, so you can't take it off and sell your vote.
Like that little thing I get with Amazon that I get to print it out and have that later. Okay, well, and in fact, a verification system has been used in Venezuela. And joining the conversation now is Gordon Strieb, an associate executive director at the Carter Center in Atlanta. He and his colleagues have been observing the referendum last Sunday in Venezuela. The recount is going on right now. Ambassador, Venezuela also used those computers last weekend, used computers. How did it work out?
Yes, good morning. Well, the opposition is asserting that the machines had several different kinds of algorithms in them. One of the most serious accusations is that the machine had a cap in it so that when the yes vote, which was in effect saying that President Chavez should be recalled, reached a certain maximum, all of the votes then after that spilled over into the no. Now, the value of the, or the advantage of the system in Venezuela is that they got a printed copy of their vote. They then took that piece of paper and dropped it into a ballot box. What is happening as we speak is our team and the OAS team are, in fact, at the place where all the voting machines and the ballot receipts are stored. They have participated in the drawing of a 150-machine sample, and they are physically counting the receipts to check against the tallies that the machines printed out and transmitted.
So the simple fact is, if there's some tampering with the machines and the vote tally that were restored digitally, if it doesn't tally with those boxes that were kept at the ballot box, clearly something's wrong, and you can find out right away.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult, at least as far as I know, it's pretty difficult to do other kinds of things with the machines so that there's a discrepancy between what you are counting in terms of the physical paper versus what was tallied in the official election results, and you couldn't catch that by a count of those physical ballots.
Well, that was my question to you, Ronnie, is that your title in The Nation is provocative. How could they steal the elections this time? I assume you're referring to the Republicans, but the fact is this, I mean, it's not a question of whether any particular party, the Libertarians, can steal it.
Well, and in Georgia, it was the Democrats who put in the all-electronic system that you can steal because there aren't any paper ballots.
Right.
In Nevada, it's a Republican Secretary of State who is going to have paper ballots on the DRE. I mean, so that you have, it's not a clearly partisan issue in any way. The policy issue here is, do we want private companies counting a Democratic election? And I think the answer is no. It hasn't even been asked yet as a question, but the answer should be no.
Yeah, I think there was an overreaction to a certain extent. The secretaries of state rushed out quickly to try to deal with the problem and got ahead of the fact that there are now some very reliable machines that do give you a good paper ballot trail and so forth, and then now they've invested all that money, they're reluctant to go back, and so they want to convince us that their machines are reliable, and all I'm asking them to do is, okay, tell me how you tested the reliability of your machine.
Ambassador Strieb, the OSCE is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, is now sending observers to the United States to observe in November. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that we're using this system?
Well, I have no doubt that up until the year 2000, there was this sort of misguided confidence in our system and that the weaknesses in it got exposed at that time. And so just as we have promoted the OSCE going into observing, monitoring elections all around Eastern Europe and elsewhere, we now have an obligation to allow them to come here and do the same thing. And I have no doubt that what has stimulated this interest from their part, at least, is that the questions are being raised about the reliability of our system. Now, how far they can go into that with a relatively limited-sized delegation that will arrive somewhat late in the process remains to be seen. I really think it's more of a gesture to show that there is international concern, but I don't think it's going to solve the kinds of problems that Ronnie Duggar has identified.
Are you worried that the legitimacy of the process could be seriously hurt at the end of this election if it's a closely contested race?
Yes, I'm concerned about that, especially the way the last one was resolved, which was not the Supreme Court part of it, but the way it was handled in Florida. We also tend to forget we had quite a few states which were very, very close. which could have been also challenged. So I'm really concerned that if we don't open this up in some way so that there can be greater verifiability, there is going to be a lack of confidence in our system. And, you know, the worst thing is if we have a very, very narrow election and the results are once again in doubt, no matter who the winner is.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for having us.
Gordon Strebe is Associate Executive Director at the Carter Center for Peace. Ronnie Duggar is a journalist whose article appears in the August 16th issue of The Nation.
Still to come, track and field competition is about to be off and running in Athens. We'll have a preview.
And dance inspired by Tourette syndrome.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Many of you took us to task for the interview we did yesterday with Danielle Pletka of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute on Democratic candidate John Kerry's speech to the veterans of foreign wars. Several of you wanted to know why we would ask a conservative to comment on the Kerry speech. The answer is, for the same reason we asked a Kerry campaign advisor to comment on President Bush's speech to the same organization on Monday.
Also during that interview, Pletka mentioned her dismay at an ad which she attributed to the progressive group MoveOn.org and which compared the president to Hitler. As John Walsh of Worcester, Massachusetts points out, the ad in question was submitted with thousands of others to the MoveOn website in a contest. MoveOn took the material off its site as soon as it became aware of the content. And MoveOn, of course, did not run the ad or even allow it to compete in the contest.
During a discussion we had earlier this week with USA Today reporter Andrea Stone and Denver Post Washington Bureau Chief Jack Farrell, we talked about the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. That's an anti-Kerry group that released both a highly critical book and a scathing political ad about Kerry's war record. John Benson of Charlotte, North Carolina writes, I thought the piece was irresponsible journalism. It repeated the assertions from the Swift Boat ad and did not say that they were unsupported or that the people in the ad had no direct experience with John Kerry in Vietnam. The lack of qualifying statements created the impression that the charges were credible. Did you hear me yelling at you from my car? Yes, John, we did. We heard a lot of people, both by phone and email, and we would like to clarify. Three of the backers of the Swift Boat Group have financial ties to the Republican Party. John O'Neill, co-author of the book, did not serve with Kerry, nor did any of the men in the television ad. FatCheck.org, a nonpartisan watchdog group that monitors political ads, points out on its website that veterans who accuse Kerry are contradicted by Kerry's former crewmen and by Navy records.
John Kennard of Concord, Massachusetts, wrote in response to a brief story we ran on Michael Moore's posting of a quote from Porter Goss, the Republican congressman tapped to head the CIA. He writes, when you introduced the segment, you said in the interview, Porter Goss says he is not qualified to run the CIA. Since the question Goss was responding to was not part of the Moore clip you played, unless you have more info than I do, it seems unfair to assume that was the question he was asked. It sounds to me that Goss was saying he wouldn't qualify today as an agent or analyst, given the CIA's current needs. Well, according to Michael Moore's website, the exact question Mr. Goss responded to was, you come from intelligence. This is what you did. This is what you know.
And finally, Colleen Greer of Tucson, Arizona, asked about the song we played at the end of our review of the new film, We Don't Live Here Anymore. Well, it was Book of Love by the Magnetic Fields off the CD 69 Love Songs.
The Book of Love has music in it. In fact, that's where music comes from. Some of it is just transcendental. Some of it is just really dumb. But I love it when you sing to me and you.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay
I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Entering the final week of Olympic competition in Greece, some long-anticipated track and field events move into the spotlight. This is the part of the Olympics that has been most affected by scandal, with doping charges dogging the American team. And this week, Greece's top two track stars having to bow out amid questions about their failure to show up for a drug test. All of which notwithstanding, there are economic implications, too. Could it be track and field that fills those empty stands at long last? Well, joining us on the line is Ron Rappaport, sports columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Ron, welcome.
Thanks, Gail.
Bring us up to date, if you will, on these doping questions about the American competitors, including sprinter Tori Edwards.
Well, this has been going on for over a year now, ever since an anonymous coach sent in a syringe containing remnants of a designer drug that nobody knew about. And so all of American track and field has been thrown into turmoil. And as you say, it's come down to Tori Edwards, who's one of the top women sprinters, has been kicked off the team. And Gail Devers, one of the great champions of all time, will be taking her place. And so, but they're not the only ones who are implicated. Tori Edwards is the only one who's been kicked off the team. But such is the state of track and field these days that almost anybody who runs well is implicated.
And remind us about the two Greek athletes who had to bow out this week. What happened there?
Oh, Gail, I feel so sorry for Greece. Here they are after all this struggle and all this agony, and they're going to lose a fortune on the Olympics because the security costs, and then people didn't show up anyway because they're nervous. And then finally at their great moment, the day of the opening ceremonies, which everybody agrees is beautiful, their two top Olympic athletes, including the defending champion in the men's 100 meters, were accused of drugs in sort of a Keystone Cops play out. They claimed they were in a traffic accident. They ended up in a hospital. Nobody could see them. They had missed drug tests. There's no way to explain that in American terms, that two of your top people, who the whole country views as heroes, being kicked out of the Olympics, and one of them was going to carry the torch.
Well, besides everything that has already been done in the drug and doping tests, is there anything else that Olympic officials could do to clean up this sort of thing?
Not really. The trouble is that once you find a test for one thing, then they come up with another drug. What they have started doing, and it makes people like me very nervous, is saying, well, we don't need drug tests anymore. We're gonna use non-analytical positives. There's a euphemism for you.
We'll take your word for it.
People squealing, diaries that may indicate this or that or the other thing. They come to the point where we can't exactly prove anything, so we're going to go to the next best thing.
Well, in the few seconds we have left, can you give us a quick guide as to who we should pay attention to, special attention to, in the big track and field events?
It will be interesting to see whether Gail Devers can do well again. You know, she's a two-time champion in the hurdles, has never won a dash, and she might have a chance at it. Gail, she's 37 years old. That would be a tremendous thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And whether Maurice Greene could retain his status as the world's fastest human, which has eluded him for the last couple of years now. I think the competition in track and field is going to be tremendous, and who knows, maybe for a couple of seconds we can even forget about the doping scandals.
Yeah, we'll hope. Thanks, Ron.
My pleasure.
Ron Rappaport is a sports columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Tourette's syndrome is a neurological disorder characterized by involuntary physical or verbal tics. It's not often the subject of art, but some Boston-based artists are featuring Tourette's in a new dance piece. Paul Im is a musician and co-founder of the Modern Art Movement, an arts production company that's producing the dance, and Diane Arvanitis-Noya, who along with Tommy Neblett heads the Prometheus Dance Company, which is performing it. And Paul and Diane have joined us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about this, Paul. The title of the piece is actually a Greek word. What does it mean?
The name of the piece is actually Anadinioia, and it means resurrection through movement. I wanted to use a Greek term because the Greeks were very concerned about the human form.
And you have Tourette's.
Yes, I do. And this is deeply personal to me. And I feel very connected to the work that Diane and Tommy have done with the choreography and to the music.
Diane, tell me a little bit about choreographing a piece like this. One of the characteristics of Tourette's is, of course, unpredictable movement. So how does a choreographer cope with that?
It was fascinating. We see it, the impetus and the sort of drive behind what happens in Paul's body was very beautiful to us, and so for, we had to see it, not just read about it, but see it in order to understand where we were going to begin. So we used the ticks as a sort of impetus for the movement, and the first section very much deals with the uncontrollability of what happens in the body, and took it further so that it would transform into movement.
You heard Diane Paul describe the movements as beautiful, interesting, but you, let me ask you this, if you've noticed that people can be uncomfortable when they're in your presence, in the presence of someone with Tourette's, because they're unpredictable. People want predictability when they're coping with another person. Were you worried that this can't be done?
I think that actually was the impetus for the whole thing. You know, I think for speaking with someone who has had to cope with Tourette's syndrome for so many years, you naturally see people that are scared, people that are afraid, people that don't understand. And I think that what we wanted to do with this event was to take something that is normally distracting and chaotic and to really try to reveal something beautiful and to see if we can find subtle things and subtle ways of seeing the movements a little bit differently.
Diane, had you any experience with Tourette's before this?
None. We studied some literature and film and had discussions with a couple of people about the experience from childhood to diagnosis and really paid attention to the difficulties, the social isolation, and success. Paul's very successful and he's very talented.
You actually, in fact, you walk on stage with a saxophone. You play a sax solo.
I do, yes. I'm a jazz musician by training, actually, and I think Tommy and Diane choreographed me into the piece.
We did.
and I found out about this recently, so I'm definitely up to the task. I think it'll be...
But you can do this now, because that does require some physical control over the instrument, and you play sax.
Yeah, I think that's something that, I mean, being a jazz musician and playing the saxophone is something that's something that I have to cope with and I've been dealing with for years. But this particular one it's going to be challenging because I'm going to have to actually walk and play at the same time.
And be on stage, I guess.
And be, right, yeah. So...
We're talking, too, about Tourette's physical tics, but there's no verbal Tourette's, which is some, in many ways, I suppose, the most famous aspect of Tourette's, but perhaps the least occurring.
There's a very small percentage of people with Tourette's actually have vocal tics. I think the choreographers made a conscious choice to leave the verbal tics, you know, verbal representations out of the piece. And I also think, from a composition standpoint, it is represented in the music. If you listen carefully, it's subtle, but it's there. Most people going into the event will know clearly that it's inspired by Tourette's syndrome. But it's not about Tourette's. It's a dance event. It's a celebration of your movement. It's an art celebration and a non-Tourette's clinic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to make that distinction. So social isolation, acceptance, and how a person deals with these things are very. I think that those are things that are very, very apparent. And those are the things that are important. Those are the things we have revealed through this particular inspiration.
Paul Im is co-founder and executive director of the Boston-based arts production company, The Modern Art Movement. And Diane Arvanitis-Noya is co-artistic director of the Prometheus Dance Company. For more information about Anadimio Ia, please check out our website at here-now.org.
And a quick correction. Konstantinos Kandaris of Greece was the Olympic champion in 2000 in the 200-meter race, not the 100, as our guest just said. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.